other Mr. Known. UFOs, aliens, ghosts, Bigfoot, conspiracies and cover-ups. And to the paranormal we go with Jeremy Scott.
And hello from the McMinimins UFO Fest in McMinnville, Oregon. I am Jeremy Scott, and we are back here. It seems like an eternity since we were here last before Kratos 2019. We did the show like in some dark dungeon last year. Hope you guys were able to catch that one. There's no parade. You guys happy the parade's back this year? I don't see anybody dressed up in costumes. But I want to welcome my first two guests here because this is just an amazing time that we're both living in here, or all of us actually really living in, because I don't know if you folks know. Do you know what's happening next week in Congress? Do you know that they're going to be talking about UFOs? And this is the first time in 50 years since the end of Project Blue Book that we've actually had a hearing on UFOs. Here from Politico is Brian Bender, and from Open Minds TV is Alejandro Rojas. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Alejandro. What a day to be living in. I mean, here we are, 2022. Many folks thought we never lived through a pandemic. Seems like we have lived through it, and we're on the tail end of it. And on the other side of the black hole, which they just released a picture of a black hole yesterday, is a hearing on UFOs. Now, you can be as skeptical as you want. Is anything going to come of this?
Definitely something will come of it. What is the question? And that's exactly what they're trying to figure out. So one of the issues was, you know, Lou Elizondo, who ran that program where he looked into UAP at the Pentagon, he worked for the intelligence. He would look for OSD, and he left because they weren't paying enough attention to the topic. The problem is, and he has voiced concern, is that now that the Congress has demanded that they do something about this, the project ended up back with that same group who kind of, you know, Lou had a problem with not doing anything. The great thing is, and you know, he was concerned they were going to drag their feet. He was concerned they weren't going to do anything about this or take it seriously. The great thing is that, you know, Congress seems to have the same concern, and they're not going to put up with it. They're saying, you know, it's great you're sending us that you have UFO reports, but we need actual analysis. We need you to come up with a plan to take these reports, to scientifically investigate these reports, and to figure something out. And they're not going to take no for an answer. They sent a very strong signal, something, a development that seems to have happened last night from a trusted source. And I think this is Brian would agree, this is a trusted source who gave us this information, is that they have chosen a lead for this group. And it's a really long acronym. They used to be called the UAP Task Force. Now they've got this long acronym for their new name. But this guy who's going to be taking over is a physicist. He is someone who's dealt with a lot of scientific research for the military and the Pentagon.
Do we know his name?
I do have his name. His last name's Kilpatrick. I would have to look up the rest. But if it's true and this guy's taking over, it's definitely a good sign. It's kind of like, you know, they got yelled at and in trouble for not doing anything. So they're like, okay, we're sorry. Here, we've assigned a guy. We're going to get moving. So hopefully they'll take this seriously. I think that what we're going to see coming up in these hearings is more procedural. It's more going to be about, hey, get this done. Why aren't you getting this done? Let's hear your excuses. Let's get past this and come to an understanding. So I'm not sure that we're going to learn anything new, but hopefully this will move the process forward to where these investigations will get going and research will get done. And they'll take this whole process seriously.
Maybe more mainstream coverage, though, and less poo-pooing, you know, the labels of wearing the tinfoil hat. These are just crazy kooky people. Yeah. I mean, when you see this actually up on Capitol Hill, this is playing out on Fox News or CNN or whatever.
That's a great point. And I think that's where it will serve us even more. You know, fortunately, we have people like Brian Bender in the mainstream who have been taking this seriously. And what I love is when, you know, mainstream journalists who are embedded in the defense industry get involved with this, like Brian has. He's been able to break a lot of incredible stories about what's going on behind the scenes. I would argue that his article from last week had a lot to do with these hearings even happening, where he wrote an article about how Congress was really dissatisfied with the progress. And hopefully, you know, with Congress doubling down, you know, that we're taking this serious, more media will start to get the hint that this is a real deal. We need to take this serious and cover this more often and in a more serious manner as well.
Brian, your reaction to all this, and please do share with us some of those latest developments, as Alejandro just alluded to.
I would agree that I think, like anything in the government, they got to walk before they run. And I think this hearing is part of this multi-year effort now of Congress exerting more oversight on this issue. Some might say Congress is catching up and, as always, is behind the curve on this. But I think they are getting serious about it. And as Alejandro said, I think a lot of the hearing will be about process. What is the new structure in the Pentagon? How is it coordinating with other agencies? How are you collecting this data? What are you doing with it? Who are the experts you're going to be reaching out to crunch it? You know, the federal government reinvents the wheel all the time.
True.
And so I think that's kind of what we're seeing now. They're putting the wheel back together, hopefully in a way that is more useful than something like Project Blue Book, which, of course, is a couple generations ago. We have a lot more technology now, whether it's machine learning, AI, data analytics. If you have credible data that can be verified, sifting through that, finding patterns, and ultimately maybe finding answers. I do expect there will be some questions at this hearing, sort of bigger picture questions. In other words, not bureaucratic, who's running what office and what's your budget and all that stuff. We'll get a lot of that. But I think there are members of Congress genuinely interested in the woo-woo. Like, you know, what do you know? What do you think you know?
My question is, are there too many of them who don't believe in that who are going to shut it down?
I think there's enough of them that are willing to go there, whether they have preconceptions about what these unknown or unidentified craft are or not. I think we have a new generation. I mean, people are more open-minded. Science has come a long way since 1969. I mean, scientists are studying consciousness and life after death and, you know, stuff that in the old days may have been really fringy. And so, you know, I think science has also moved on. And so I think that's contributed to elected leaders in this case being willing to ask some questions. One other thing I will say, though, is expect a lot of this hearing to also be about national security. In other words, bringing it back to earth, so to speak, and through the lens of, okay, whatever you think these things are, we have all of these credible reports of intrusions into protected military airspace, and we don't know what they are.
Yeah.
So how can the Pentagon be doing its job if it's not trying to figure out what they are? Somebody said, I thought very aptly, if these unidentified craft had Russian or Chinese markings on them, the Pentagon would be running around like a chicken without its head. We need more money. We need to find out what it is. We need to collect data. You know,
but if it's the ETs, then what, we can just not investigate it seriously or what?
Or we genuinely don't have good answers. And, you know, if you're the head of the Air Force, for example, the last thing you want to do is go before the American public and the world and say that basically the reason why we exist on Earth, which is to protect American airspace, we can't do it.
Yeah.
There's something out there that completely renders useless all of our defenses. So I think there's a big level of not wanting to talk about it simply for that reason. If they don't really know, they don't want to admit that.
You made a great point, you know, about are the people who don't believe going to come in and poo-poo this whole thing. I think we're past that. And I think that these hearings might be a hallmark of that, and I'd love to hear Brian's opinion on this as well, is that I think all of those people have already come out of the woodwork. All of the people who would want to shut this down have already come and made their efforts, best efforts, to do just that, and it hasn't worked. So I think that everybody's already given their perspective, and we've heard from all sides, and it hasn't shut down. So I think we're past that. I think there's too much momentum. How much momentum there are, I think we'll be able to much better gauge that at the hearings as well.
Now, Brian, you didn't start on this trail of looking into UFOs. I mean, your career at Political didn't start with this. So
no,
how did
I,
it start?
I stepped
how did
into
it evolve?
A big rabbit hole. I was just walking along and
you got sucked through.
Yeah, I mean, I covered the military and the Pentagon and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for a long time, and this was an issue that virtually never came up. I mean, it was never talked about. You know, obviously, we all have interests in Hollywood and movies and books and science fiction and all of that. And so I can't say I wasn't intrigued by the topic, but it was just not something I covered until 2017 when...
right before Christmas, right?
Well, that's when the story's first published. But it'd been a good part of that year of 2017 of sort of digging into this, what we now know of as ATIP, but this relatively small project in the Pentagon that was created by Senator Harry Reid to look into some of these reports. And, you know, at first, I admit I was like, really? The Pentagon's looking at UFOs? I mean, isn't that sort of like Cold War ancient history stuff? But it was clear to me as a political reporter at the time that it was a political story, too. I mean, here you have a senator from Nevada who's putting money into the budget secretly with the help of some other senators, sort of foisting it on the Pentagon. I mean, this is not something the Pentagon – normally they request a budget. They say we want this project and that project and money for this. They didn't really want it. It was an add-on. And, oh, lo and behold, most of the money went to Bigelow Aerospace, uh-huh, run by Bob Bigelow, yep, who's a campaign contributor of Harry Reid's. I mean, you could argue that there weren't that many smart people in the world who could actually do that government contract. And so I think it made some sense that they went to him. But, you know, that intrigued me about it, too. It was an innately political story. But, you know, as I dug into it, and as obviously Lou Elizondo came forward publicly, this former Pentagon official, he was a compelling character. Here's a government official coming forward and publicly saying, we're not doing enough about this stuff. So that's how it really came together for me. It was a good story. I mean, aside from what it was about and sort of how, you know, how far you can take it. And I think since then, what we at Politico have tried to do is do what we do on every policy issue, which is to cover the government workings, the paper trail. What is Congress doing? What is the Pentagon doing? What are they spending it on? Who's doing it? And so that's sort of, I think, where we've added some value. I mean, as far as like the bigger questions, you know, we're trying not to get into that because, you know, as you know, it's hard enough to get objective facts in your
sometimes
day-to-day.
It's opinion, really, more than anything.
Yeah, and theories and but, you know, that's why focusing, I think, on the data and the science and really taking modern techniques to try and play with this information in a way that I don't think they could do in the old days. And I think that's what Congress wants, is just a much more sophisticated government coordinated effort, as public as possible, understanding that some of it they're probably not going to be able to talk about. But, you know, more investigation, more transparency. And again, some of it is going to be reinventing the wheel, but I think you almost have to do that. I mean, particularly on this subject, there's so much scar tissue if you look back in the rearview mirror that you almost have to build it again.
And you mentioned following the money, so I'm interested in, do we know anything about, is there official government funds being spent with this? Because we know ATIP was funneled through the Department of Defense, and Harry Reid, as Brian alluded to, was, you know, a big part of that. Do we know anything about money that the government is spending now to investigate UFOs?
I mean, we haven't reported this yet.
Exclusive. You guys want an exclusive?
Well, I've been told that, you know, one of the questions that came up when the defense bill was passed in December and Biden signed it, which created sort of this new effort, really. You know, Congress mandated the Pentagon had to do certain things, create this new awful acronym office that I don't even say it either because it's somebody's going to change it probably in 2 weeks anyway.
Can we just call it UFO office? I mean,
yeah. That's the fact that UAP office.
UAP office, sorry.
But, you know, that's what sort of got this really moving is there's a law now on the books. It's pretty specific about what the Pentagon needs to do and the deliverables, so to speak, it needs to provide to Congress. The question I had at the time was, well, where's the money? Because this is an authorization bill. So it's basically a policy bill, but it's not an appropriations bill. It's not like here's $50 million to go do this. So I am told, and this is sort of the news here, is that there was an appropriation, but it was in the black budget.
So of course.
It's classified, but there was an actual line item of funding.
We would expect
I don't know
it
how much,
there.
And it's probably, you know, in the Pentagon, it's probably not very much.
Drop the bucket.
Relatively. So I think there is money. I think I wouldn't be surprised if on Tuesday at this hearing we hear the Pentagon sort of bitch and moan like they do often about, whoa, we need more money. We need more resources. If you really want us to do this, give us more resources.
Yeah. And I would say that the other kind of short answer to your question would be yes and no. We know how much, you know, the project that Bigelow was involved with. And it gets so complicated and confusing. And we'll be sharing the more details at lunch. But, you know, essentially that first program, that $22 million, New York Times said that was all about a UAP project. It wasn't. And this is kind of what, you know, I've been reporting on for a while. Brian's been reporting on this. It was a paranormal project. That $22 million went to Bigelow Aerospace to investigate poltergeists, Bigfoot, cattle mutilations, portals to other dimensions, a plethora of phenomena, and UAP was just one of it. When Elizondo came in, and he kind of clarified recently, he had decided we're going to get rid of all this paranormal stuff. Not necessarily that he wasn't interested, but that they were taking a lot of heat from it internally, especially from religious factions who were like, this is demonic. We don't want to deal with this. So he got rid of all of it except for the military UAP research and then just went with that shorter acronym ATIP and went forward with it. By that time, the budget was already spent. The $22 million was gone. But what's interesting about this and what I keep saying as a takeaway is the DIA spent or the DOD spent $22 million to do a paranormal investigations. The contractors that they contracted and the DIA agent who was in charge of that investigation all came to the conclusion that all of that phenomena was real. That was their conclusion.
Imagine that.
So we know about that $22 million. Otherwise, we don't necessarily know. We like Brian gave you the latest on what we know, how much they're spending on this UAP task force. It's all black, so we don't know. But the other thing that they keep saying is essentially in Brian's article when he went to research, what's the progress? What's going on? How the lawmakers feel about the progress thus far? The insiders that he talked to kind of gave him the answer that we're working on essentially coordinating and getting buy-in from agencies. Dean Johnson, who is that person I alluded to earlier who gave us that other news, he clarified to me and he said, these aren't other agencies. These are their own agencies. So they don't really know what their own agencies have done in this field yet. And it sounds like they're still even struggling with trying to get them to come clean on what they have worked on. So nobody knows that. I think it's part of what they're trying to figure out, and they still haven't figured that out, is the impression I get.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I mean when I say reinventing the wheel. I mean, I think there's this impression out there, and even those of us who cover the Department of Defense or the National Security State fall prey to this too, that, you know, somehow what the government knew then, the government still knows now. I mean, these jobs change. People come and go, particularly when you're talking 20, 30, 40 years. This sort of institutional knowledge is lost, particularly when you're talking about agencies that have these sort of secret components to them, sort of this honeycomb system where you're on a need-to-know basis. You may have a really high security clearance and know lots of things, but it doesn't mean that you're read into every little thing that the CIA or the NSA or the DIA is doing. So I think part of the challenge in collecting what do we think we know as a first step to sort of what more can we learn is what Alejandro is talking about, is just sort of figuring out what is even out there. What do we know? What do we have? What sensor data do we have on this phenomenon that might go back many, many years? And either agencies are resistant to provide that, or because they don't know how it's going to be used or perceived, or agencies don't even know that they have it. Because if the guy who was in charge of that for 30 years went off and retired, it doesn't mean that he, you know, the young guy coming in or young gal got handed a big fat file or a big thumb drive. So that's what I mean about reinventing the wheel. I think we're really in the early stages of that, and that includes just figuring out what's buried. You know, I always picture the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark in that big warehouse. Like, you think somebody's got an inventory of that place? No, they don't. They don't even know what's in there. if right. a place like that exists. And, I'm not saying it does.
1 minute for both of you.
Yeah, I was just going to follow up that, you know, a lot of people, I think, have a little bit misperception about how things work. Really, things work inside the government and all these agencies, much like they work in all of our work environment. You know, when someone quits and you're like, hey, who's going to take up this? Oh, Sue used to do that, but she's not with us anymore. How'd she do it? I don't know. And you've got to reinvent everything and start from scratch. Same thing happens in government.
And if they do discover something that's like, oh, wow, that's really interesting. Well, I didn't know we had that. There's also probably reluctance to share it because then you're also acknowledging that we've been sitting on this thing for 50 years or 30 years or 10 years or you know. So I think it's not as simple as we'd all like it to be. I mean, I wish it was that simple, which is, you know, it's in room number 7 in file drawer number 5 and, you know, cough
well,
it up.
Well, it was 50 years ago, but now it's moved.
Or so. Thrown out.
Or thrown out or discarded. Well, I want to thank both of you for coming and joining us live here from McMiniman's UFO Fest. It's Brian Bender and Alejandro Rojas.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Tell the audience where they can follow you guys online.
I'm easy. Brian D, like David Bender. So Twitter's probably best.
Yeah, because we're newsy. Twitter.
You've been kicked off Twitter once or twice?
I've been kicked off. I just
upsets a lot of the UFO Twitter people.
Sometimes I should just grin and bear it. Let's just say.
Yeah, I think we could all learn a little bit from that. Well, we'll let you guys go, but thank you so much for joining us here from the McMiniman's UFO Fest. I'm Jeremy Scott, and we've got a very special guest coming up with us next here from the UFO Fest.
The foundation
so don't go anywhere.
Paranormal News. This gives a whole new meaning to the term brain fog. Researchers have studied the brains of 15 astronauts, which could be vital to the future of space flights as NASA considers longer missions. Dr. Juan Piantino of Oregon Health and Science University's Department of Neurology says it comes down to sleep.
We noted that their brains do adapt to this lack of gravity. What we don't know is how long does it take for a brain to just be overcome by this lack of gravity.
The study found that space flights alter the fluid-filled spaces along veins and arteries in the brain, which is our most active organ. Those cells consume a lot of energy, which creates waste that is then flushed out by water when we lay down and sleep, something we take for granted, but that's not possible for astronauts. I'm George Henry, Paranormal News.
After decades of public denial, the Pentagon now admits there's something out there.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. My gosh. They're all going against the wind.
There's stuff flying over military installations, and it's not ours, and no one knows whose it is. You should find out what it is and tell us.
People want members of the government to say it's extraterrestrial. We won't stop there.
Look at that thing. It's rotating.
House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff said the hearing would give the public an opportunity to hear directly from subject matter experts and leaders in the intelligence community on one of the greatest mysteries of our time. One of the greatest mysteries.
The government is part of the cover-up. They're not going to disclose it to us.
From McMiniman's UFO Fest in McMinnville, I'm Jeremy Scott. So honored to continue our live broadcast here today with the man sitting next to me, who is a man that you have seen, no doubt, on television. You've heard him on radio, and he's now here live and in the flesh. Hello, Willie Strieber. Say hello to everyone.
Hi, everyone. It's good to be here. Good to see everyone.
Willie, it's really, really good to see you. It's really good to get to do this in person. You know, the pandemic really has taken kind of a toll on all of us. And you're going to be doing this with a mask and without a mask because you have a very personal reason for that. Let's get us started with what we talked about with Alejandro and Brian just a moment ago.
Okay.
Because I want to get your take on it. You've been doing this an awful lot of time. I don't want to date you. I don't want to ask how long you've been doing this. But, I mean, you're free to volunteer that information.
Sure.
But did you ever think you'd live to see the day and age when we'd have a UFO hearing in Congress?
Well, considering we've had them before in my lifetime, yes, I did expect that there would eventually be more. Because there's a lot that needs to come out, and there are people within the government who have known that for a long time. What needs to come out is an admission. It is that this is not just about things flying around in the sky. It is in our homes, in our bedrooms, and in our lives. And there's nothing anybody can do about it. The Air Force cannot protect us from this threat from the skies, if it is a threat. And we don't even know that at this point. And that has to be faced. The deafening silence from the Air Force through all of this process of disclosure is getting a little scary. They have to come forward and tell the truth, because this is profoundly, as well as the truth of every single person on planet Earth, it is the truth of institutions, great institutions like the U.S. Air Force. They have to admit that they cannot stop this, and that it does happen to people in their homes, in their lives.
Like it happened to you.
It happens to me. That is correct. And I'm sure there are other people right in this room it happens to. And it is a not a commonplace experience, but it's not rare either. When I published Communion in 1988, there was an absolute explosion of reaction from around the world. People began to send us letters, hundreds, then thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and got to the point where the post office was bringing bags of mail or big boxes of mail and pouring them on the floor of our apartment in huge heaps. And I was at a loss. I'd never seen anything and dreamed anything like this would happen. My wife, however, was not at a loss, and she said, "We are going to organize this." She hired a secretary who turned out to be a close encounter witness herself and was with us for 15 years. They organized these letters. I said, "Ann, we are being beaten up in the media. Nobody believes, no one in the academic community or intellectual communities will give us the time of day. Let's throw these letters out. They're just in the way." She said, "Nope. There will be a time when they are very valuable and needed." Now those letters, which we did keep all of those years, are archived at Rice University and available to the academic and scientific community for study. And thank God, because they represent an immense outpouring of the most complex human experience in history. Far and away, the most complex human experience in history. That complexity has never been dealt with. When it's discussed in the public at all, it's talked about in terms of the abduction phenomenon, but that's only a small part of it, small part of this incredible joining of us and our lives by this presence, which I will not tell you is an alien presence because I don't know the answer to that question. So,
I mean, Whitley, you've learned a lot through this process. What are some of the highlights of what you've learned from they or them?
Well, I think the most important thing I learned was not from them. It was from my wife. She said, "The human species is too young to have beliefs. What we need are good questions." And when it comes to this, that is absolutely the truest possible thing and the best way to approach it. We are already way ahead of ourselves, assuming that there are even people with maps, star maps of various stars that they come from, et cetera, and the names of all of the different species. We're not there yet. So that's the most important thing I learned. Now, as far as from them is concerned, that's a much different sort of a question. I have, by living with them as long as I have learned that they are very reflective. In other words, if you're afraid, they're going to react to that. I'll give you a perfect example of that. There was we had a lot of close encounters, group close encounters, and close encounters among individuals at our cabin in upstate New York in the old days. And there was once a film group there that were making a documentary. And they, of course, were from Hollywood and had no expectation of anything unusual happening to them. There were cameras all around. And I will say now that I have lived in a world of cameras for years and haven't gotten anything yet. I'm close. I got one or two things that I'll show in my lecture tomorrow, but not anything definitive. Anyway, the film crews, the husband and wife in the film crew were sleeping in the living room on a convertible couch because the house was packed. The husband wakes up and to his horror and amazement sees a little man standing beside the bed with a great big head looking down at him, which he thought was absolute nonsense. He was laughing about it a few hours before at dinner. And then there it is. He's face to face with it. He experiences terror, and it immediately changes its appearance like a blowfish would, or like an animal reacting to fear by changing its appearance, and it turns into the head of a hawk. In other words, this is not some mysterious thing. It's a reaction by a being that has a different way of living than we do, and it's a defensive maneuver. Then it disappears. About an hour later, my son and I are coming up from out of the woods because we camped out because the house was so full of people. And we're walking up to the house, and we see this sort of translucent hooded figure come out the front door, come down the deck, we were facing this deck, come down the deck and race off into the woods, darting between the trees as he goes. And we go in the house, and the filmmaker, the poor guy and his wife, are now on their feet because they thought the bed had caught on fire. They were experienced a huge wave of heat. And there was a physicist there. And he said, well, you know, this is actually explainable. Whatever it was had probably technology that enabled it to bend light. But to do that, you would have to be able to control gravity. And that would inevitably generate heat. And when it saw you coming up, it realized it would be trapped in the room if it didn't get out of there. Released some of the heat for whatever reason and left. And that's the heat they felt. And it was translucent to you because it had released some of this heat in order apparently to move freely through the woods. So you're looking there at something profoundly different from us that lives, thinks, and is different. But at the same time, is using a comprehensible technology. The moral of the story is, as crazy as it seems, we will be able to figure this out if we put our minds to it and stop drawing conclusions before it's time.
What are some of those dangerous conclusions that you've seen people jump to over the time, Whitley? Like labeling everything aliens or extraterrestrials or something of the kind?
Well, all the labeling has to go. We have to start from scratch now. And now we can. Because I hope that one of the things that's been a tremendous problem has been a lack of granting in this area. And also a lack of interest on the part of scientists, psychologists, biologists, and academics, because the academic community has a huge part to play in this. What do our gods and so forth and demons and sylphs and all of those things actually mean? Is this part of life on Earth, or is it something recent? We need to find that out. Biology needs to play a role in it. In particular, well, for example, the work that Dr. Gary Nolan and Dr. Kit Green are doing on brains, which was recorded in Vice recently, and I'll have Gary Nolan on my show, Dreamland, soon to talk more about it. All of that, much more needs to be done because they're hardly funded at all. We need to study the brains of people who have this experience because we already know that many of them have unusual brain structures. What does that mean? Does it mean we're generating the experience? Or does it mean that you need to have this kind of brain structure to see it? What does it mean?
So are you alluding to consciousness in some capacity, Willie?
I'm alluding to perception.
Okay.
For the close encounter witnesses, many of them have got an area of the brain called the striatum, and I'll talk about this tomorrow also. There's a link between two parts of it called the caudate and the putamen, and these nerves that link these two things are very dense, unusually dense in these people. Does that mean that they were always like that, or did the experience change them somehow? We don't know. And it can't be that everybody who has had the experience is like this, because this is a pretty rare brain formation as far as we know, and millions of people have had the experience. Why do they have it and not others? And what is it? We assume we know what the experience is, but when you read the letters that Anne saved, you find out very quickly this is a very deep, complex, extraordinary experience, which abduction is a part of, but not the whole thing. So how do we find out what's really happening? We can, using functional MRI scanning, we can interrogate people who have had the experience, and their brains will tell us what parts of the experience are of their memories are being assembled from physical experience and what parts aren't. So we'll be able to tell what their bodies thought was physically happening to them as they narrate their experiences, as opposed to what they believe happened but is actually part of their imagination. And we'll eventually, if we have enough money and enough time and can do this with a couple of thousand people, we'll be able to build a baseline of what the contact experience actually is. And this has not been done. None of it's been done, and it needs to be done.
Yeah. Now, you were alluding to why some experience these more than others. So that leads me to my next question. Do you believe some folks are chosen to have these experiences, and were you chosen, Whitley?
Well, let me put the mask back. I'm going on vacation in a week. And I intend to go on vacation.
We intend for you to go on vacation.
So that's why, folks, on Facebook, you're seeing this mask going up and down. Anyway, what was the question?
Were you chosen? Do you believe some people are chosen?
Question. I forgot. Yeah, I've been asked that question a lot. I have a tendency to forget the questions I've been asked a lot. I don't know. They said that, but why me? They've said that we got a lot of letters from people who were told that, and it might have been an attempt to calm them down. I don't know. It made me nervous. I didn't know what to think of it because it also made me feel a little bit, you know, on the spot, because chosen for what?
Yeah.
They didn't say that. But, you know, the bottom line with the abduction experience is this, and this is only part of it, but it's the bottom line. Women's eggs and men's semen is taken. This is taken. There's even a report out there that I've seen. I can't offhand remember exactly where it is, that there's an admission that there have been some unexplained pregnancies.
Yes, and by the way, that came in a recent revelation. The Sun, who looked into the 2017 ATIP report, filed this Freedom of Information Act request and then waited 4 years and finally got this 1,500 pages, which said unaccounted for pregnancies, radiation burns, and whole nine yards. Take it away, Willie.
Well, okay, I have lived with, not with the unaccounted for pregnancies, but with disappearing pregnancies, and of course, a man's semen is his version of a woman's egg. And I had that taken from my body involuntarily. And I am haunted to this day by wondering what happened to it. Because the ability to create another human being was there. And we don't know. I don't know. Do I have children? A lot of people think they do. And we could, because you take eggs from women and semen from men, you're going to be able to make children.
Yeah.
So where are they? What were their lives like? What are they like?
Would you want to know?
Yes. I want to know my children if I have children. It's as simple as that.
Even if they're a mixed alien-human hybrid.
I don't care. I will take my children in my arms if I can. Period.
Let's give that man an applause right there. Okay.
Well, thank you. But the government has to face the fact that this happened, that they were unable or unwilling or afraid to do anything about it. This is the core admission that has to take place before we move ahead. And unless it does take place, this is not going to unfold correctly. Right now, there are going to be congressional hearings with two men, one of whom from the Navy probably doesn't know anything about this. The other one maybe does. But it comes down to the Air Force. The Air Force has got to admit that there were abductions and they did not stop them and couldn't stop them and can't. Now, that said, the abductions, it would appear, have been over for quite a few years now. They appear to have trailed off in the late 90s, and now there are just a few occasionally happening. But many of the people, like me and like so many others, who were involved in those days are still involved. The visitors are in our lives in all kinds of bizarre ways. Not bad. I mean, in my case, I'm beginning to find it terribly fascinating. And, I've written about it in a book called A New World a couple of years ago. And it's still a remarkable thing. It's absolutely remarkable. So, I don't like what happened. But I'm living with it.
Well, let me ask you this, Whitley. If it got us closer to understanding the phenomenon, would you allow it to happen to yourself again?
I would not. I would resist the removal of semen from my body without my permission and understanding of what was happening, because I think it's immoral. In my world, this is not a moral thing to do. Of course, if somebody thinks of us like we think of cattle, then maybe it took them some time to discover that we had more sensitivity than that. Or maybe they haven't discovered it yet. I don't really know. But no, I think it's immoral to take that from conscious beings and who to create other beings that are on a journey like a human being is on. It's not right.
I'm afraid this is the final question we have for you, Whitley, but do you think that there's some agenda here, an agenda by the ETs, by the aliens?
Well, clearly there is. You don't do that to people unless you have an agenda, unless you want to do something with their sexual material. So that was definitely there. Now, as far as other agendas, they constantly talk about to close encounter witnesses about the dangers of the collapse of the environment. And that does appear to be happening. So that's been a big feature. What does that mean? It means they want us to survive. Another thing that indicates that they wish us to survive is, and there are some excellent studies of this that have been done, they have been very interested and challenging at missile control sites, both in the United States and in Russia, maybe in China too, I don't know. But they have obviously been very concerned about nuclear weapons. And after all, they didn't start to show up in numbers until right after we had a nuclear explosion over a couple of cities in Japan. So the message here is clear. They have an agenda when it comes to the human body and the human soul, I would presume it's as well. And they do want us to survive. That's clear. As far as the rest of it is concerned, I don't know.
Whitley, what would your final words be for this audience sitting with us here this morning?
Even if this gets hard, and it could get hard, persevere. We will find our way with them, and we will make communion with them in the end. They wouldn't even be here.
There he is, ladies and gentlemen, live in the flesh from the McMiniman's UFO Fest. It is Whitley Strieber. It was such an honor to have Whitley here. The man deserves a round of applause. Thank you so much. Enjoy your vacation, and we hope to be able to talk to you once again. We'll continue from McMiniman's UFO Fest in McMinnville.
Don't venture too far. You might not make it back into the paranormal. Out there, well, they'd probably be listening to this show. You're in good company. Into the paranormal.
From the McMiniman's UFO Fest here at Hotel Oregon, I am Jeremy Scott, and this is Into the Paranormal. And sitting next to me, let's hear it for Kathleen Martin.
Thank you.
I got egg on my face, and I committed a boo-boo in front of a live audience. Kathleen has not written a book with Whitley Strieber, but she has written a book with the late Stanton Friedman. So set me correct, Kathleen. What's that book about?
Well, there are actually three books. The first one was Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, my research and investigation of my aunt and uncle's abduction in 1961, and Stanton was a scientist who was very involved in that. And the second one was Science Was Wrong, the history of science over the past couple of hundred years, and scientists who were politically motivated to give false information. And the third book that we wrote together is Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, the history of government involvement in the investigation of UFOs, their findings, the decision to cover up their findings, and those who were involved in the cover-up and what they did to every major case in history.
Well, perfect time for you to bring that up, because we've got congressional hearings happening next week in Congress where they're going to talk about the UFO topic. So speaking of government involvement and cover-ups, what do you know, Kathleen?
I know a lot about that, because I wanted to know initially why the government was covering up the facts in my aunt and uncle's case. And what I discovered is that the military was very much concerned about public hysteria. Also, back in the 40s, when they began this cover-up, They didn't really understand what was going on. They've done major studies and found that between 20.5% and almost 27% of their cases had no terrestrial explanation.
Where have we heard that before?
And so, they just, the Robertson panel met in January of 1953, CIA funded, with government connected major scientists, and reviewed some of the cases and made the decision that the public should not know the truth. And they wanted well-known scientists and writers to write books and magazine articles in order to distort the information and cover up what was actually occurring, to make witnesses, even the most credible witnesses, seem somewhat silly, and to rewrite what had occurred so that the public will be confused with all of these different speculative arguments and therefore not believe that it was really true.
That's what they want us to believe, is they want us to believe that none of this is true. But Kathleen, the stories say otherwise.
Absolutely. There is a tremendous amount of evidence that this is true, that it is occurring. In fact, there is scientific evidence, the evaluation, the scientific study of UFOs and the photographs of UFOs. I'm going to be showing some of that tomorrow in my lecture. I'm also going to be showing an abduction in progress.
You're going to what?
Be showing film.
Oh, film of an abduction in progress. Somebody actually being taken?
Not just one person, but three people. And
whoa.
Stanton and I had a personal relationship to this. The Spirit Hunters of the South, two women who are well-educated, met Stanton at a conference where they were both speaking, and Stanton was very impressed by their knowledge of physics, and they wanted to do an experiment with a confirmed abductee, or experiencer, if you want to call it that. So Stanton introduced me to these women. I introduced them to the confirmed experiencer. They went to that individual's house and carried out their experiment, but they got something that they didn't expect. All three of them were taken to craft. Now, they had a Bell and Howell movie camera running in another part of the yard, and I am going to be showing the video and the stills, because I did a frame-by-frame analysis on the video. It's only a few seconds before the camera shut down, but enough so that I was able to find several non-humans on that film. I'm going to be showing the film and the stills tomorrow.
Can you mail it to Congress and have them play it on Tuesday?
I wish I could. I wish they were interested, because I'd be happy to share any information.
All they
have
to do is take the wax out of their ears and listen to people like you, and they'll realize that these people aren't kooks.
Absolutely. There are many credible people with good reputations who have had these experiences and have been reluctant to come forward with that information due to the ridicule factor that has haunted us for many, many years. But finally, we're having some limited disclosure. So I'm really heartened by this, and I welcome any involvement from the military. I have shared information with some people, and I'm happy to do that.
Did you ever think we would be living in a time, and I guess what a time to be having this, that we would be having congressional hearings into the topic of UFOs? And will this actually make more than 30 seconds on the mainstream news?
Boy. Well, there were congressional hearings a very long time ago, and also hearings at the United Nations. But I thought that this would never occur. And I'm really delighted.
So why now, Kathleen? Any idea?
I think that so many people have had these experiences.
Evidence is overwhelming.
The evidence is overwhelming. The government looks foolish. The military looks foolish because so much evidence has been produced and shown to the public. And also, many people in the military have had their own sightings, and some I've worked with, some who have actually been taken to craft as well. So it's time. It's time to have limited disclosure. We have technological progress to the level where we know more. We're not as superstitious as we were in the 1940s or early 1950s. And the public around the world deserves this information. I believe that people deserve the truth. But I think that if we have public hysteria, that what is going to happen is that the lid will come down again.
Photos. I'm interested in your thought on photos, because a photo is what brings us here together actually today. In the 1950 photo, May 11th, the Trents on their farm, 7:30 at night. Evelyn's out feeding the chickens, and she looks up and she sees this metallic flying saucer object, and she runs back in and she gets her husband, and they come out and they've got a camera, and they got to go like that because this thing zips off. They're able to get pictures of it. Those pictures go around the world. They're analyzed by the Condon Committee, by Dr. Bruce Maccabee, and they've been put through the ringer. Nobody has been able to say that those were faked, that those were made up. There's wild theories that people have come up to try to explain that. Here's where I come from, is somebody who, you know, interviews people like Kathleen and investigators every week on the show, is I try to come up with an objective way of looking at this. And honestly, I don't think that that technology existed in 1950 to fake what the Trents captured on film.
Well, some people are still saying, skeptics and disinformants, that it was just something thrown into the air, or it was suspended from
And how hard is that to capture? You try throwing something. Here, I'll throw something right there, and how many people can capture a picture of it?
Well,
no one.
I'll tell you that last week a man did send me a picture of a silver-colored Frisbee that he threw into the air and actually captured on camera. But I could tell that it was a Frisbee. It didn't look like alien craft to me. So, that's another attempt by these skeptics. And I don't know if they're frightened. I don't know if they're being paid. I don't know why they're still coming forward with this false information.
I don't think they are anymore. I think they've been silenced. I think they realize the evidence against them is overwhelming, and there's nothing that they can add to try to sway someone's opinion either way. What do you know about the McMinnville case?
I do know that Bruce Maccabee did a very, very good scientific evaluation of that photo. He is a physicist, an optical physicist. He was a consultant to the Navy. And it is one of the best photographs on record. I can tell you that a photograph of something that looked identical to that was captured on gun camera video in Rouen, France. I have difficulty with pronouncing the French word. But it was captured on video. You look at that, and it's exactly like the McMinnville UFO. And then take a look at the recent evidence of the gimbal video. And it looks the same. I'll show those to you tomorrow. And so
there's some similarities between the McMinnville photos and the Tic Tac, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yes. And we certainly did not have that technology on this earth in 1950.
No, didn't exist. Didn't exist. So, Kathleen, as you've looked into these abduction cases, what have you learned? Have you found trends? Have you found patterns? Have you found something that could give you some sort of indication on like I asked Whitley earlier, what the agenda is. It's not just to abduct people. In Whitley's case, it was to take his semen, and we've heard about those reports in other abduction cases. But what's going on here?
Well, let me tell you first that I've been studying this for a very long time. I was the Mutual UFO Network's director of experiencer research of that team for 10 years. We had about 100 to 150 experiencers coming to us every month. So I have all of that. I've been talking with experiencers of contacts for 32 years or more now. I've worked on three major studies on experiencers with more than 5,000 experiencers. And there are different agendas. For the most part, it appears that they are concerned about us, about humanity's behavior, and they want us to survive this technological development that we have that is out of sync with our spiritual growth. And when this occurs, then it threatens life on the planet. And so they are concerned about an environmental collapse. And I know that they're taking semen, they're taking ova. I'm not sure if they are still doing it. There's certainly far less of that happening today, according to the experiencers that we talked to.
And so they've changed up their game a bit, is what you're saying, Kathleen, a little bit.
Yes, yes. I know that they were doing a longitudinal genetic study to attempt to improve the human genome and at the same time to increase our level of spirituality. There are certain characteristics that experiencers share. And we've learned this through the three studies I've worked on that compared experiencers to members of the general population. Also, academic studies indicate that experiencers have the same characteristics as near-death experiencers. They become more spiritual. They become psychic or at least a little more insightful. They become empaths where they can sense the emotions of another person as if they were their own. They can they know the health of the human body. They can feel this in their own bodies. Some experiencers have become healers. They're able to channel something that heals others. The most recent agenda from all of the people who have had contact for many, many years, as reported to the MUFON's experiencer research team, is that they are healing people. I know people who have had cancer, heart disease, many other things who have been healed by these non-humans. And also they're giving information to them. So it's very important for us to all look at that information. I'll be presenting some of those statistics and information tomorrow morning at 9:30 in my lecture.
Kathleen, your newest book, Forbidden Knowledge, A Personal Journey from Alien Abduction to Spiritual Transformation, really focuses a little bit on your story and how you've evolved through this process. We actually did a full 2 hours with Kathleen on episode 479 about 2 months ago. But Kathleen, for the audience here at the UFO Fest, how has this affected you? How has your personal journey and your spiritual transformation evolved?
It has helped me, or affected me profoundly. And I have only begun to talk about this. I wrote about it in my book. But when my Aunt Betty Hill was working with a team of scientists to call in a craft to land, one did come in. It landed on my grandparents' farm across the street from my childhood home. It left physical trace evidence on the ground. There were two witnesses to the craft, and my mother and I remembered being taken to craft that night. She lived her lifetime without ever revealing it. I thought that I would as well, that I would only leave that information to be revealed after my death. But people have talked me into coming forward recently. And that is the driving force. I want to know the answers. I'm not a person who is totally involved in waiting for the government to reveal what they know, because what they know and they're releasing slowly is what
things.
I've known for at least 30 years or more. So, it has changed me profoundly. It has made me seek the evidence and not wait for the evidence to come.
Were you worried at some point, I guess, that maybe somebody would come after you or somebody would try to silence you? I think I called our episode the ET muzzle because of exactly that. There does appear to be a muzzle over researchers and experiencers.
Well, I was threatened in the past. I was, with my life, with my family's lives, intimidated. Occasionally at conferences, some nasty man will come up and try to intimidate me again, but I won't be intimidated. I will not. I'm searching for the answers. I'm searching for the truth. And I think that I, as a citizen of this country, deserve that.
I agree. Do you guys agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
Kathleen, what's next for you in this field?
Oh, boy. I'm not sure. I just released Forbidden Knowledge. In that, I have a communication experiment that I participated in for a number of years. 120 questions that this research team asked these non-human entities and their detailed answers. I'm just continuing to look for the answers, because nobody has the answers yet. I certainly don't. I have little snippets of information.
We brought you the new. I want to go back to the Betty and Barney Hill case, and I want Kathleen to give us not a synopsis of the case, because we've heard you talk about this, mm-hmm. but what have you learned in the investigation since then?
In the investigation of the case? Well, let me say I'm still investigating it. And I started investigating that case in 1990. I was 13 when it happened. So I saw the unfolding. I saw the evidence initially. And the way it was handled, I have the initial report to the Air Force, to Project Blue Book, and then I know how the falsified report was put out by Project Blue Book in 1965. I know that Dr. Donald Menzel, who was an arch debunker, and how Philip Klass, who was the go-to guy for the mainstream media, worked as volunteers on Project Blue Book in that time frame. And I know the disinformation that they spread and how it impacted my aunt and uncle. I lived with my Aunt Betty during my college years. Barney died in 1969 at age 46. I was a student at the University of New Hampshire, and my aunt was helping me. And when Barney died, she asked me to move in with her. I saw the psychological operation that was going on against my aunt. I know that the phone was tapped. She told me to listen. We had an intercom between she was upstairs and I was downstairs. And on that intercom one day, I heard what I thought was my aunt coming home, maybe for lunch. She was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. I went running up the stairs to greet her, but she wasn't there. And I thought, isn't that strange? Well, maybe she just stopped in to pick something up. I went back downstairs to pick up my book I was studying, and suddenly I heard running, crash, bang, a lot of noise. I went dashing up the stairs, and the front door, the locked with deadbolt lock door to her apartment was open to the hallway. The front door of her house was open. there was a baseball bat lying on the floor. It's a good thing I wasn't in front of that closet that that man came out of. The gate was open, and there was a man in a beige-colored suit running up the street. That was no common burglar. So I know that there was a psychological operation going on when Barney was alive, and then after he died, they thought that they could send Betty over the edge. Betty was an incredibly stable and strong person, and they didn't. But they certainly tried to intimidate her, and she did not come forward with any of that information except to certain scientists, and the family was sworn to secrecy. And so it wasn't revealed. They didn't succeed in what they were attempting to do, and that was to dismiss the Hill case.
Imagine
completely.
That, a little bit of an intimidation tactic on a witness. Kathleen Martin here from the UFO Fest. Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Thank you so much.
We will be back after this with Dr. Irina Scott from the McMinniman's UFO Fest in McMinnville. I'm Jeremy Scott.
See something like that.
One of the most incredible images of a UFO ever taken was just outside the town of McMinnville, Oregon on May 11th, 1950. The object seen around the world was witnessed by farmers Paul and Evelyn Trent. Evelyn was feeding their chickens and rabbits around 7:30 at night when something grabbed her attention. She looked up to see a large, metallic-looking, disc-shaped object silently hovering in the sky. She ran inside for her camera and called for Paul to come look. What they saw changed their lives.
I would say right around the size of a big parachute, maybe a little bit bigger, but right around that size. It went fast. I've never seen anything go so fast in my life as that thing went.
The couple snapped two pictures, but the film wasn't developed for another month. It was then that Paul showed a friend who alerted the telephone register. The newspaper ran the story on the front page, and it went national. They were inundated with tens of thousands of requests for copies at 10 cents apiece. The national press dubbed the town of McMinnville Saucerville, and a media circus ensued. While being interviewed in New York, the Trents let the producers borrow the negatives and never got them back. But there was no shortage of pictures to analyze. The Air Force and FBI reportedly visited the Trents and questioned them, but nobody could prove the pictures were a hoax. Then, in the 60s, the Air Force, in conjunction with the University of Colorado, commissioned the Condon Committee to investigate the UFO phenomenon. During their investigation, the mangled negatives turned up 17 years later. After 3 years, the committee concluded the Trent sighting was one of the few reports that, when investigated, appeared to be consistent with the assertion of an extraordinary flying object. Further investigation in 1975 by optical physicist Dr. Bruce McAbee put the photos through every kind of available test.
The clear, very clear shape and description of the dynamics, how the thing flew and so on, make it clear that it was not any flying craft built by human beings.
The findings by Dr. McAbee and a number of other leading researchers strongly supported the conclusion made by the Condon Committee. Despite baseless claims from critics, the Trents never made a dime. Speaking about it for the final time in 1998, they said they didn't want the photos, and if they had the chance to do it over, they would not have taken the pictures because of all the troubles the publicity brought. Still, with all the evidence on their side, skeptics continue to make wild claims, such as the camera lens being oiled. It was an outdoor light swinging from the power lines above. Even the rearview mirror from a 1940s pickup truck, and the list goes on. One thing, though, is for sure, interest in the Trent UFO sighting of 1950 remains alive and well.
Sporting a tinfoil hat and looking dang good in it. Into the Paranormal with Jeremy Scott.
Welcome back. McMinniman's UFO Fest live here from Hotel Oregon in downtown McMinnville. Welcome, Dr. Irina Scott. Doctor, tell us how you got involved. Give us, the audience, a little bit of your background and how you got studying the topic of UFOs.
The way I got involved was that I've been in science my whole life, but I was involved right from the start when we were tiny children. My sister and I saw something that later we found out related to UFO phenomena, but we had it in our bedroom. And then we had other sightings, but I didn't talk about it for years and years and years because I was in science. So I was involved from before I ever heard of UFOs.
Did you think that talking about UFOs, being involved in science, might discredit you?
Yeah.
But these days we've seen the UFO topic take on a more scientific element.
Yeah, which is very good because they have radar and the Nimitz and the jet planes and Princeton on radar and the whole thing. And it's been taken a lot more seriously with the type of new radar they have and that type of thing.
What's your reaction? Have you seen any of that stuff like previous? Because this all came out, you know, in the early 2000s, was released in 2017, and you know, the world's become aware of it over the last 5 years of what those videos are. But have you ever seen anything that behaves the way that that craft did?
Yeah.
My sister, with your own eyes?
Yeah.
Okay. But that defies all logical explanation, right? Because seemingly it shouldn't be able to operate in the way it does with what we know about our current state of aviation.
Yeah, they definitely, they can disappear and appear and just do a lot of things, go so fast you can't see them. And what they showed on the radar, it would accelerate and fly away so fast that the gravity would just smash a normal, you know, anybody. They can travel so fast and come out of water and all kinds of things.
So in your sighting, did the craft make a sound?
No. We had a close encounter, and there was no sound.
Any visible exhaust?
No.
Any weird behaviors that it made? Maneuvers, I guess I should say.
Yeah. We had a close encounter in Massachusetts, my sister and I, later, and the object... at first, she was saying this is odd, and at first I didn't believe her. But she said it would appear one place, disappear, and appear someplace else and disappear. And then later, I saw it moving. It was circled an airport, and I saw it moving so fast you couldn't even see it. It would half of a circle. It would just be like that, and then very slowly, and then zip. So
outpacing the speed of any other aircraft.
Yeah, and it didn't make any sound when it did that.
Amazing. Did it just poof, gone like that?
No, we followed it for a long time and followed it through a real bad old road, country road with potholes and everything. And finally, we couldn't follow it any farther because it was just going a little too fast for my car to make it over a real bad road, and so we had to quit following it.
Interesting. How long were you able to visibly see it then, though, for a little while after that?
Oh, we saw it for an hour or two.
Now, anything else happened? Did you have any missing time? You said you had a close encounter, so besides just seeing this thing up close, or did you have anything else? Telepathic communication, anything like that?
I don't know. I can't answer it. We had seen it from Boston as we were leaving Boston, and my sister said, "Watch this thing, it looks like a UFO." And I was telling her, "No, it couldn't be. The police would be out, you know, looking at it, and they'd be photographing it and things." So we argued about it, and as we were driving along, we passed a woods, and there was this light. It looked like it was almost on the ground, and it was a light that was going through a spectrum of like red and blue and then red and blue, and I had no idea what it was, and the inside of the car lit up in green for a while, and I didn't know anything about UFOs, and so I just made notes about it real soon afterwards, But we continued, and then my sister started yelling at me that this thing's going over the road. And so then I saw it close up, and it was quiet. It had seven square windows, real big ones. And we discussed whether they're windows or panels, and we'd both seen blimps with lighted sides, and we didn't think they were panels. We thought they were windows, and we thought we were looking inside it. But it was very, very brightly lit. We couldn't see anything inside it, light fixtures or anything. And then I was trying to take a picture of it. I worked for the DIA, and I had a real high clearance, and I was in photography. And so I had a high-speed film with me and a camera. And so I thought, I'll get a wonderful picture of this thing with the seven windows and the freeway and everything. It was dark, but I could still take it by high-speed film. And as I just had a camera loaded and ready to get the picture, this man in a truck pulled over and came up, and he asked what I was doing. And I pointed at him. I didn't say UFO. This big thing was there in the air. He should have seen it. And he wrote, turned around and looked in the exact opposite direction and said, I don't see anything. Then he turned around to me, and he said, what are you looking at, or what are you doing? And I pointed again, and he turned around and looked in the opposite direction again and said, I don't see anything. Then he turned around and looked at me, and he sort of gave me the crazy sign some way and went back to his truck. Well, then my sister said later that when she thought I was loading my camera, that I took a real long time, and that the thing had zipped over and gone, it was like it got to another place right then. And I didn't notice it, but that's why it was farther away when I stopped talking to the man. And so I did get a picture, and I published it in a scientific journal. But anyway, then it starts circling the airport and going at different speeds. And we had to, I was still trying to get a good picture, and she wanted to. She was trying to figure out why we couldn't see anybody inside it. You just see nothing. And so anyway, I pull on the freeway, and the truck driver pulled right behind me, turned on his bright lights, showing him in my mirror, and followed us. And
another intimidation tactic.
Boy, it sure was. I thought we were going to die, and I didn't even say goodbye to my sister. If I changed lanes, he changed lanes. If I sped up, he sped up or slowed down. And I couldn't get rid of him. And I didn't know what was going to happen because I thought he could knock us off the road. But finally, I decided that I would be on the left-hand lane. And whenever I came to an intersection, I just swerve off as fast as I could. And that was very dangerous because somebody else was coming up on the other side. We'd be dead, and I'd be blamed for it. But I did it and got rid of him, so far as I know. And so then I turned around and came back, and the thing was still circling the airport. But then it started going northwest. And so we followed through a zigzag of roads, and finally we wound up on this real old country road with houses far apart and potholes and gravel and no place to turn around. And it was just going too fast for me to follow it with my car, and so I had to turn around. And at the time, I was working for the Defense Intelligence Agency, the one involved in all these videos and things, and with a real high clearance. And so I couldn't report it, but I took real good notes right afterwards.
Yeah, I'm interested because you worked at the DIA, and you primarily specialized in satellite photography. And so I'm interested in your studies in satellite photography and how you apply that to investigating some of these pictures of UFOs, like the Trent sighting here in McMinnville.
Well, I think what I was specialized in was air order of battle, and I was identifying airplanes from satellite photography. And it was over Russian territory, so it was all very, very, very classified. But it was something like Trent. It's been analyzed by top people like Bruce McAbee and everything. So
basically say it's irrefutable.
Yeah.
And are there other pictures? What are some of the other famous UFO cases that have been pictured that you've taken a look at?
Well, the one I'm doing my speech about is the Pascagoula abduction.
Calvin Parker and Charlie Hicks, yeah, in 1973, Pascagoula River, Mississippi. By the way, how's Calvin doing?
He's doing better.
That's good. Good to hear. I'd hope to get him on the show, but he's been doing some health. He's been going through some health issues, so I'm glad to hear that he's better. You have not stopped investigating this case, much like Kathleen, who has not stopped investigating the Betty and Barney Hill case. The Pascagoula abduction is your baby. So tell us about what you've learned in the 49 years since.
Well, in the 49 years since, there's been a change in people. Back then when it happened, nobody would talk about it. And they said that on the same night that the Pascagoula abduction took place, the police had reports of formal reports from 50 people and a whole lot more calls, but nobody gave their name or anything. And even Calvin Parker didn't talk about it for around 50 years. So there was a very, very lot of harassment. But then, in the recent, since about, 2017, when that came out in Time Magazine and everything. Well, people are being more forthright and not hiding away, such as what Calvin Parker did. And so there's been a big change in people, and especially after June last year of when the government report came out and they said, something's flying around the air, maybe.
Well, there was no doubt that something was flying around in the air. It was just what excuse they were going to use to try to say they could identify it.
Well, they called Uncle, which they haven't done for.
they what? What was that?
They called Uncle on it. I mean, they said,
"No, yeah.
We don't know."
Yeah,
and that's the first time they admitted it.
Yeah, they don't know yet. There's this catch-all other bin, which basically says we don't know what these are. So they'll tell you one thing, and they'll give you the Reader's Digest version, which says, hey, there's nothing here. But then if you read and you start to pick it apart, you realize that the summary does not meet what's inside the actual report. But far too few people will actually go beyond the Reader's Digest version. They'll just take somebody's word for it. But if you read what's in that report that was released last June, it clearly does say, look, the majority of these are unidentified, and the majority of these were also tracked on multiple radar systems.
Yeah, they had radar and visual both. And so, they're real good data, and with the newest radar and everything, too. And so they're having trouble refuting it.
Speaking of new radar, just to kind of rewind to last week on the program, our program Triangulating the Tic Tac, where we actually talked to a group who are actually using military-grade equipment in the same area by triangulating the location of where the Tic Tac was actually filmed in Southern California. And by triangulating it and using some of this new radar, well, they actually find something, and I don't want to give it away, but they actually find I guess an entry point or an exit point. So do you believe that these craft are coming from somewhere, or are they here? We just don't see them.
I think they can be here and not seen in the same way for entities or whatever. I think to us, they can just appear someplace then disappear. And we don't know what's going on.
Yeah. So back to the Pascagoula River abduction, just to give some quick details on that, Charles and Calvin were out on the Pascagoula River in 1973. I'll let you pick up the story from there, Kathleen, or Dr. Irina.
Well, they were just two normal people. They had no interest in UFOs or anything like that. They were just perfectly normal people. They decided to go fishing after a day of work. And they one of them was 45 and the other one was a teenager. They were family friends. who worked at the same place. And they parked at a no trespassing sign, which made the teenager nervous because he had a new car. But they walked, they had to go through a lot of vegetation and trash and stuff and walked to a pier to go fishing. And their intent was to catch fish. And so anyway, they started fishing, and this blue thing came. And at first they thought it was the police because there was no trespassing sign. And they, the younger man said, well, if we go to jail, you're going to jail. It's your fault, you know.
Not this is him. Your idea.
Yeah. But anyway, it was much worse than the police because it turned out to be an object that was just levitating through the vegetation where they could hardly walk and got up to them. Then the thing sort of opened to something. It was this real bright light, and these things came out of it. And two of them grabbed the older man, and one grabbed the younger man. And they couldn't run away or anything because they were just like they were paralyzed. They were just, and they thought they had a shot or something, but who knows. But they were just paralyzed. They were fully conscious, but they couldn't move. And these things grabbed them and floated them, levitated them into the object.
Now, sorry to interrupt, but I believe from Calvin's account, he described these as metallic beings, not grays, but metallic.
Well, they thought they were mechanical.
Oh, mechanical, that's right, mechanical.
And they didn't think they were beings. They thought they were like robots or something that things were mechanical. And they grabbed them and took them. They floated them in the ship and in two different compartments so they couldn't see each other. And what they remember was that it was maybe they were just play acting or something. It was like they scanned them with with us, if we go into an MRI or something, there's this big machine. They put you on a gurney and wheel you in.
They don't need any of those big machines.
No, they just had little things. He described it as like a deck of cards, but you might call it an iPhone now or something. It looked like they were scanning them. And then they were returned to their place, and they were just hysteric. I mean, the younger man was standing there with his arms in the air, just stiff, just frozen. And the older man fell down, and then they started sort of coming to and getting their brains back and things. And, of course, the first thing they said back in 1973 was, we're not going to tell anybody because they'd be a laughingstock.
That was just something in the 70s you didn't say. But then as time went on, Calvin became, I don't know, more gutsy. Something happened in his life. What happened? I don't know. But he started to then come out and tell his story.
Yeah, the older man had been in the service. He'd been in life and death situations, and he was brave enough to actually say something. He thought he should tell people that there's something going on. The younger man didn't talk about it for nearly 50 years, and then they went to a funeral, and he used his real name. He'd been in hiding all this time, and people came up and looked concerned about him instead of harassing him. And his wife said, it's time to start talking. And then Philip Mantle, who published his book, also said that. And so he finally, after all those years, decided the atmosphere was better and started talking about it.
Well, I guess if there's any time to talk about it, it's now. Are you hoping anything's going to come of these congressional hearings coming up on Tuesday?
I sure hope so. I mean, it's good enough.
If you were a betting woman, would you put money on it?
Well,
that something's going to come of it?
There's a lot of things are different now.
They are.
You know, they can say, you know, we have this all refined radar and things like that. Plus, zillions of people have seen them. And so there's a lot, you know, better data and the data of all the objects they saw before they saw the Tic Tac and all that.
Yeah. Dr. Irina Scott, your final words here at the UFO Fest?
If you see something, get another witness or take a picture.
It's always good advice. We thank you so much for stopping by, making the trip out here. Let's hear it for Dr. Irina Scott. And that'll do it for us. I'm Jeremy Scott from McMenamin's Hotel Oregon from the UFO Fest. Let's do it again in 2023, okay? Good night, everyone. Thank you so much.